Before I begin this evening, let me express on behalf of my family all of our appreciation for the kindnesses that so many have extended and things that have been offered to be done for us at this time. I had hoped by the time I came back to the assembly tonight that I would have been able to have heard from Cherie and we would have some definite plans as to just exactly what we can expect in the next few days. The difficulty, I'm sure, arises more from the fact that the section of southern Kentucky where Cherie is from is on Central Standard Time, and as a result of that, that means they're an hour behind us. So things there, trying to coordinate them sometimes with those of us who live on normal time, just doesn't work very well. And so as a result of that, I'm sure that she got tied up a little bit elsewhere and was just unable to try to get that all accomplished. The boys and I will be leaving sometime in the morning after 10 o'clock and before noon. If things continue as they had hoped, we still anticipate that sometime Tuesday afternoon, probably, the funeral will take place. This afternoon, I was able to visit with Brother Cassidy for a little while, and let me suggest something that maybe we need to kind of file away back in the back of our mind. Having been gone, I understand, I don't know how some of these guys that are gone so much during the course of the year keep touch on everything that's done locally, but I assume that we are all aware of the fact that a tumor has been discovered in the hip area where Brother Cassidy is concerned, and tomorrow they're going to do another biopsy. They've already done one. They have told him that they believe that the tumor is the kind that can be treated, and in about 4 months, hopefully, all will be well. They, again, are going to do another biopsy tomorrow, and then the next day, they anticipate beginning chemotherapy treatment. The first time is going to be while he's there in the hospital. After that, he will probably be released and then have to go in kind of as an outpatient and get the treatment and return home. His anxiousness obviously comes from the fact that he may need to depend upon some of the rest of us for some transportation during that period of time. And I assured him that among those of us who assembled here at Knollwood, there would be, I felt confident, more than enough volunteers that we would be able to see that that worry was not one that he would have to be anxious about whatsoever. And so it may be that in the very near future that we may need to be kind of looking for some of us who will be able to assist him in that matter, and you might kind of file that away as one of those good works that can be accomplished where a brother is concerned, and we'll be able to ease his burden at least that much. This evening, I want us to look back at probably what is one of the more familiar accounts of 2 Kings, and that is the story of Naaman here in 2 Kings chapter 5. You recall that in 2 Kings 5, the kingdom of Israel is divided. You now have the kingdom in the south and the kingdom in the north, and the story of Naaman is set in regard to that northern kingdom that is comprised, we generally say, of those 10 tribes of Israel. It is in the latter portion, as it were, of that kingdom's existence. Ahab, who possibly stands at the very height and epitome of the kingdom insofar as wickedness is concerned, has come and gone, and we are, as it were, on the downward slide into complete and total oblivion where that northern kingdom is concerned as a nation. We also notice that if you look at this particular time, you can begin to see that situations in the Middle East have not changed much from this day until now. There is turmoil that was there in this section, and as you look at kind of the political scene and survey that of this day, one of the things that becomes readily apparent is the fact that there is a new kid on the block, and that kid is Syria. And Syria is gaining and rising in power and in strength, and is already at this juncture beginning to make some forays, some raids into the nation of Israel, and are being successful. In fact, during the course of one of those raids that have been made, there is now a young maid that is an Israelite that has been taken captive. She is taken, as it were, as a spoil of war, and she now serves in the household capacity of one who is named Naaman, who is a captain of the host of the king of Syria, and described in verse 1 as a great man with his master, one that was honorable, because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria, and he was also a mighty man. All of the things that are said about this fellow are rather commendable right there. The only problem that exists is the one most of us know about, and that is that this man was a leper. And as a result of this, he had a rather serious physical disability. It was more than just a little inconvenient to him. It was a disease that would ultimately take his life. And yet notice that this man is a very successful man. And yet, here is a man who seems to be somewhat different than the kind of people that we've been looking at least in the ruling classes of Iraq in the last few days. Here is a man who is not the top man, but yet a cruel, sadistic spirit does not seem to fill this man. The maid that has been taken captive and serves his wife evidently is being fairly and well treated, so much so that she does not view the relationship into which she now finds herself as something that is such a great burden that she only wishes despair, that she only is filled with hatred toward those who now possess her. And she speaks to the lady that she serves and indicates that would to God that my Lord would go to Israel, where there is a prophet in Samaria, and recover him of his leprosy. I'll just tell you, that's not the kind of thing that normally, in spirit and attitude and disposition, that you expect to find in one who has been taken captive by somebody else. Notice she does not wish ill on her captives, but rather she wishes good for him. And the word kind of gets passed along, and you recall how that ultimately Naaman learns of this, and then he sees that that is passed along to he who rules over him and his king. And the king has such a high evaluation of this man that he determines that what he is going to do is to send him down to Israel, to Samaria, that he might be able to be cleansed of leprosy. If there is one there that can do it, then let's send him. And you recognize that when they come down, that ultimately he doesn't come by himself. He's more important than that. He comes with an entourage of people, and he also comes with a letter of introduction. And in that letter of introduction, there is the statement that is made that we understand you can heal this man of his leprosy. And the king of Israel looks at that, and he begins to show it to some of those who are in his court, and they become greatly concerned and agitated. They rend their clothes and they say, this fella is spoiling for a fight. What they're doing is they're looking for an opportunity or an occasion whereof they may have something against us so that they can do more than just make some periodic raids in various sections of the territory that we control. They now are trying to find an occasion where they can declare war on us. Who's put us in this kind of position? Am I God? Can I make alive? Can I heal this man? You know, one of the things you've got to recognize about this king of Israel is that he recognizes that he's just human, that he's not capable of doing the kind of thing that he is asked to do. And yet there is in the land of the northern kingdom, in Samaria, a prophet by the name of Elisha. You might recall that Elisha has not really been long on the scene. If you'll turn back just a couple of chapters, you'll be thrilled with the story of Elijah and his translation into heaven. Now Elisha is here, who has been anointed in the place of Elijah to take his place as a prophet and as the spokesman for God. He has done a number of marvelous things, and evidently his fame has already spread abroad. It may be that the maid did not know of the change that had taken place here. She might possibly have been taken at some time when Elijah was still the prophet, and she might have thought that it was Elijah that she was sending this man to. But Elisha, having learned of this, simply sends word over and indicates, you send them to me. And you know, there's something remarkable about Naaman. There's some things here about this man that is a foreigner, that is outside the covenant of God, and yet he has an attitude that is very uncharacteristic of many people who were in the same kind of position that he was in. You know, he was in the palace of the king. He was where the finest was. And you know, he might have said, well, now, if you're not able to do it, but you've got somebody in the territory that can, then you send out there and you bring him in here, and he can come where we are, and we can stay here in ease and luxury until he comes and he can deal with this. But he doesn't suggest that at all. Instead, when he learns that there is one that said, send him to me and I'll take care of him, he's willing to go. And you know, the scripture doesn't say what the difference is in the two residences, but the one thing that you know is that it certainly doesn't rival that of the king. And the second thing is, when you just kind of conceive of those who were the prophets of God, do you even consider them living in the lap of luxury with a great deal of affluence round about them? I mean, most of the time you don't get that kind of a mental picture in your mind where God's prophets were concerned. I'm not saying he lived out here in a hovel or a mud hut or a cave in the side of the hill. But I am saying that when this fellow comes out there, you might be able to see why there's some disappointment on his part, and maybe even why he kind of reacts in the way that he does. Most of it comes because he feels he's been slighted or snubbed. Because you remember, when he gets there, Elisha doesn't make an appearance on his own. Instead, he sends out his servant, and his servant says, go dip 7 times in the Jordan River and you'll be clean. And you remember, that just didn't work. I mean, this fella had anticipated how it was going to be when he got over here to be cleansed of his leprosy. I mean, he probably was, at this juncture, looking for a man who would be identified as a man of God, somebody who was in contact with deity, as he saw it. And as a result of that, he had already got a mental picture of how it ought to be. And for somebody to not even have the courtesy to come out himself, to send out to a great man, as Naaman is pictured as being there in verse 1, just a lowly servant who speaks very few words and says, this is what I was instructed to tell you to do, that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And he decided that that's not what he was going to do. It didn't meet his expectation. And besides that, his nationality shows. I mean, most of us, wherever we come from, we kind of tout that place. You know, it was interesting being in Winter Haven last week. I don't know how many of those people said, what was the weather like when you left up there? You know, I really got the feeling that what they wanted me to say was, well, we had snow all the way up to our neck. And it was so cold that you couldn't step outside without being freeze-dried. I mean, when I said, well, I'll tell you what, we had a real good week just before I left. Well, we had one of those weeks where it was 50 degrees all week long. They looked at me kind of like, you're pulling my leg, aren't you? I mean, you know, they really felt like that's the place that everybody ought to want to be. And I'll tell you something else. On Friday night when I went in and they said, well, are you ready to go back? I said, yes. And they said, you are? And I said, listen, 85 or 86 degrees and 90% humidity will send me back where it's 50 degrees any day. I just don't like that kind of humidity and that kind of heat. And that was at about 8 o'clock in the morning, and it didn't get any better all day long. And they seemed disappointed. And you know why? For the same reason that all of us feel like wherever it is that we are or we're from, that's the best place to be or the best place to be from. And notice that's the reaction of Naaman here, isn't it? I mean, when he's told to go dip 7 times in the River Jordan, he gets all upset. And he talks about his own home and he says, you know, there's some rivers back home. If I've got to dip 7 times in them, let me go dip in one of those rivers. Why, they're better than that old muddy Jordan that winds around down here. I'm just not going to do it. And he heads off back toward home, just as leprous as he came. And I've said before, when I've used Naaman as an illustration, that the people in his group must have known him pretty well, because they let him ride and cool off a while, and they let him settle just a little bit. Notice that the fellows who ultimately kind of ride up along beside his chariot and begin to converse with him, they don't start out immediately trying to argue with him right there at the prophet's house. Instead, they let him cool off and calm down to where he's going to be level when they talk to him. And they don't just immediately start in and say, "Now you've got to do this. We came all the way down here to get information, and you may not like it, but that's what you're going to have to do." They don't start that way. They sidle up to him and they say, "Now wait a minute. If he'd asked you to do some great thing, you'd have done it, wouldn't you?" And the obvious answer is yes. And you know that because as you look down here in verse 5, notice he says that when he departed from Syria to Israel, he took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 pieces of gold and 10 changes of raiment. I'm going to tell you, this fellow needed an entourage, if nothing else, just to safeguard what he had taken down there, because it's a very valuable thing. We'd put that in an armored truck today to move it around. And here he is. And he understands what these guys are saying. He understands that you made anticipation that you were going to have to pay for your cleansing. And you made an abundance of that in case the price was high so you could pay it. And if that prophet had told you to do this, or if that prophet had said instead, "You give me all of this stuff you brought, or you just go out here first and you disseminate that among the poor. And when you give the last garment away, after you've given away all of those talents of silver and all of those shekels of gold, when the last garment is given away, just like that, there'll be lightning and thunder and the lights will go out. And when they come back on, you'll be cleansed of your leprosy." You'd have done it, wouldn't you? And he knew he would have. That's why he brought it. You know what? In this fellow, there's a whole lot of me and you. You know, it's sometimes not very easy to do the little things. You know, most of the time, getting a volunteer for a little thing's a hard thing to do. Everybody will take the big job. I mean, everybody will take the job that gets recognition and everybody notices it, because there's notoriety associated with that. I guess there's a certain amount of human nature kind of in that, because what it says is, I'm going to get a little pat on the back. I'm going to get a little praise, or I'm going to get something because I'm doing that. But if you ask me to do some little thing that may kind of go unnoticed or not necessarily appear to be something worthy of praise or recognition, I'm not likely to do that. And that's about the way this fellow felt. But you know, when they looked at him and he said, "Sure, I'd have done the big thing," they said, "Then why won't you do the little thing?" And he recognized the force of their argument, and he turned his chariot away from home toward the Jordan. And he went and he washed. And you know something? When God said to dip 7 times in the Jordan River, you and I may not think a great deal about that, but that certainly was a test of this man's faith. I mean, you know, he was a little skeptical to start with. It's not the way he had anticipated it. It kind of put down home where he was from. It wasn't some great major thing. It wasn't going to have a great deal of demonstration associated with it. And you know what? When he comes up out of that Jordan River after the first dip and he's still leprous, you know, there just might be some inclination to say, "This isn't going to work. Nobody ever got cleansed of leprosy like this. I mean, if this is how you got cleansed of leprosy, I could look around and the river would probably already be full of folks out here just like me doing what I've been asked to do." And when he came up the second time and he still was leprous, and the third time and the fourth and the fifth, you know, did you ever go call on somebody? Somebody that's unfaithful? Somebody that you're trying to go out here and maybe make contact with and teach. Somebody you're trying to get your foot stuck in the door with to just try to teach them something about the Lord or encourage them to come to worship or whatever. And I tell you, you get there 3 or 4 times and you never find anybody around, or you know, as I have been in some instances, I know they're in there because sometimes I can hear them in there. I've seen them in there. but they're not going to answer the door. I'll tell you what, it gets pretty easy after two or three times to say, they're not interested anyway, and not even bother anymore. This fella could have felt the same way about dipping seven times in the River Jordan. But the difference was, when he did what God said, after that seventh time, he received the benefit and the blessing that God extended. And the lesson in that for you and I is very simply this, that when we do what God asks us to do, we'll get the benefit. But we're not going to reap the benefit until we do all that God tells us to do as God tells us to do it. And this man learns that. And I'll tell you something else. This man, when he's cleansed of his leprosy, is a very thankful man. You know, generally, that's about as far after we get him cleansed of his leprosy we ever take it. Jim said, what are you going to call this tonight? I call it several things. After Paul Harvey recently, I've been calling it the rest of the story. Because really, what I want you to think about just a few minutes more with me tonight is the rest of the story of 2 Kings chapter 5 we're not too familiar with. And that is the fact that after he's cleansed of his leprosy, he goes back to Elisha's house. And he goes back to say thanks. He goes back because he's brought this great gift with him in verse 5. And he says to him, you set the price and I'll pay it. You've given me something that nobody else has been able to give me. There was no physician anywhere that could have cleansed me of my leprosy. He possibly was a fellow who had been to the various gods that his forefathers had served, and they couldn't touch it because they weren't gods. But Jehovah, he alone was God. And he wanted Elisha to know, one, I'm thankful. Do you remember in the ministry of Jesus that on one occasion he healed 10 and only one came back to say thank you, and the Lord said, where are the 9? This man was like that one. He recognized the benefit and the blessing that he had received, and he was not going to go away unappreciative of that. Secondly, this man was impressed with God. Now, he wasn't very impressed when he walked away from the prophet's house the first time, because all of us know, I don't know how many sermons have been preached about the statement that he made when he said, behold, I thought, and away he went on all the things he thought he'd do. He really thought God would be a God of spectacular demonstration. But when he found out God was going to work in another way, he wasn't too satisfied with that. But now he is. Now that he's gained the benefit upon the conditions that God has laid down, he comes back and he says very freely, God alone is God. And I'm not going to worship and serve anybody else other than God. Now he says, I do ask to be excused because my position is going to require that when the king goes into the house of the main god of the Syrians, that I am expected to walk in there with him. And I'm expected to be reverential when I go in there. But I'm not going to worship him. I'm not going to reverence him. I'm not there like my king is there because I alone know that I'm God. But I'm going to find myself in the same position, brethren, sometimes you and I find ourselves in. Have you ever had somebody die, maybe in your family? Or maybe just somebody that's a friend? And you've gone into some denominational place of worship because that's where they worshiped, just to pay your respects? Maybe you've gone there in the hopes and the interest that what has happened will move them into some greater interest to the truth of God, and you want to be there if there is that spark to be able to say, let's investigate what Scripture says. I'll tell you, like most of the rest of you, I guess, I've been in some things that I've sat in amazement at what some have done in the religious world and identify as worship. So much so that sometimes when I listen even to some of my brethren, generally some of my younger preaching brethren, who get on those of us in the Church of the Lord for our traditions, and I know we've got some, but they get on us because we get a set routine, you know, where we have two or three songs and a prayer and another song and the preaching, and then like we do on the Lord on Sunday morning with the Lord's Supper and whatnot, and they get harping about that. Listen, they've never sat evidently where I've sat. I sat in some places where when you take a book out like this song book, it tells you everything that's going to be done and when it's going to be done and who's going to do it. And when they say this, you say that, you can go through that thing and there not be a bit of meaning in it. Now, there can be, but you're going to have to work at it. And if you want tradition, you can find it there. And I've been places like some of the rest of you where I was there because maybe who was there was somebody who was a companion of one whose companion that was with them is of something else, and we've stood up and sat down and we've done everything. And just to be respectful, you know, you try to fit in. You're not worshiping. You're not doing a thing that they're doing, believing that it is of God. But you're being respectful. He says, that's what I'm going to be. I'm going to be expected to do certain things, and I'll do it just as I see it, as something that is nothing. It doesn't mean a thing to me. And Elisha doesn't look at him and say, now wait a minute. If you believe God, he alone is God, you don't dare do that. He didn't do that at all to him. In fact, he looks up at him and he says, you'd be excused. And finally, when he finds that he cannot get him to take any reward for what he's done, I mean, he tries several times. He starts out for home. And then you get the rest of the story, don't you? Because now you get a picture of a man by the name of Gehazi, who was a servant of Elisha. And this fella is just unlike everybody else in this story that can possibly be, like day and night. Because Gehazi is a very covetous fella. Gehazi is a man who really looked at Elisha and reproached him for refusing to take the goods that had been offered to him by Naaman here. The generosity that's seen in Elisha toward Naaman is absurd to a man like Gehazi. Not only that, this fellow is a liar and a conniver. He's got a very vivid imagination. This old boy runs out after Naaman has left and started toward home. He gives him a head start, and he takes off after him. And they see him coming, and they stop and wait. And evidently, he's recognized very readily. And Naaman comes down from his chariot, and he says, is everything okay? And he says, oh, yes, yes, everything's just fine. But something unexpected came up. There are a couple of the sons of the prophets that have come unto my master, and he really needs to give them something. And we don't have anything that we can give them. And he makes the implication, at least, that Elisha has sent me out here to take something of you, not for himself, but so that he might be able to give it to these other honored people that's now come to visit him. And if you could just give us a talent of silver and two changes of raiment, why, my master would be pleased with that. Now, I want you to notice something. When he starts all of this, he says, as the Lord liveth, there in verse 20. Do you notice he's not embarrassed at all bringing the Lord into the scheme on his part? He'll use the Lord just like he'll use anybody else to get what he wants. I guess this old boy would be called resourceful in modern America today. But it ends out worse than he anticipates. You remember, Naaman looks at him and says, well, don't just take one, you take two. Oh, no, one will be enough. My master only sent me for, well, you take two. Well, no, I can't do that. Yeah, take two. Well, okay, if you insist, I'll take two. I'll take two talents of silver and those two changes of raiment. Now, maybe the only thing right here that he doesn't quite anticipate is that rather than just loading him down and sending him back, Naaman sends some servants back with him. And now he's got a problem because he's out here all on his own. He's out here because of his own covetousness and his own greed and his own driving desires. And he doesn't dare let Elisha know what's going on. And so now he's not only got the stuff that he has to worry about, he's got the people that are bringing the stuff for him back. And he comes back to a certain point and he kind of indicates, now, you know, if you fellas come in bearing this, these guys that we're going to give this to, they're going to know it's really not from my master, and it's not going to reflect well on him. Maybe you ought to kind of leave it here, and I'll take care of it from here. It's close enough for me to deal with now. And these fellows are like most of the rest of us, you know. They wanted to get on home, and off they go. And so he goes and hides that. And then he comes in into the presence of Elisha. And you know, he said, "Whence comest thou, Gehazi?" Verse 25. And he said, "Oh, thy servant went no whither." "Well, I didn't go anywhere. What do you mean? I'm seeing you a little bit, but I've been busy. You know, you give me jobs to do. I got responsibilities around here. I'm out here doing those things that you expect me to do. You want a running rundown on my time? Tell you where all I've been, what all I'm doing?" But Elisha said unto him, "Went not mine heart with thee, when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money, and to receive garments, and olive yards, and vineyards, and sheep, and oxen, and men servants, and maid servants?" He said, "I know exactly where you've been. My heart was with you. You've forgotten. First, you've forgotten the all-seeing eye of God. You've forgotten the presence of God. And you've forgotten that I'm a servant of God. God informed me of what you were doing. You've been tested, Gehazi, and you failed the test miserably. It wasn't a time to take presents of these, but you took them. You took them in my name. You had no regard for how it would make our nation look, or how it would make me look, or how it would make God look in the eyes of the Samaritans or the Syrians. What you did, you cheapened God. You made it look like he was no better than those gods that they served there in Syria, when God had demonstrated by his great power and his great might in the cleansing of this man in such an ordinary, unexpected kind of a way that he alone was God, and God in his simple workings convinced that man of that. And look what you've done." And then the leprosy thereof of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever. And he went out from his presence a leper, as white as the snow. What a terrible exchange that was made. This fellow wanted the goods of Naaman. Notice, as greedy as he was, he didn't want all of them. And you know, this fellow would have probably given them all. He'd have just gone out there and represented it, because he came prepared to give. And he'd already answered his own servants that he'd have done whatever was asked of him to do. He really didn't ask for a whole lot in comparison to all that this man had. But he still got more than he bargained for, didn't he? And I'm going to tell you, there's a real lesson in that for us. You know, you see that out here in society every once in a while, don't you? Here's somebody that's a teller at a bank and embezzles funds. And they get more than they bargain for when they get caught. They exchange a job of honesty and decency for prison bars. Or you take, maybe here's young people who will exchange school opportunities for a life of crime. Or here's a man who exchanges a good wife so that he can just go out here and have a fling with some young thing somewhere or another. Or here's a Christian who exchanged the hope of heaven, maybe for a few more minutes sleep, so that he doesn't have to come to Bible study. Or maybe he'll exchange the hope of heaven because he's more interested in TV programs and all of the things that are associated with this world than his growth and his development and his maturing as one who's a child of God. Somebody who'll exchange their soul for something that's material. This man didn't exchange his soul, but exchanged his health. And how many times has it been that some of us have been somewhere, or we've said maybe about something that's presently afflicting us, "I'd give up all that I've got if I just had my health back"? I'll just tell you, I don't know how many times I heard John Burris say he'd give up just about everything he had if he'd just be able to feel good again. I've known a lot of people that are like that. You know, this man, I'm sure, rued the day that he ever followed out after Naaman in his covetousness and got the exchange that he got. Does this not give some force to the words of Jesus in Mark chapter 8? When he said, what will a man give in exchange for his soul? What has a man profited if he gained the whole world and lose his own soul? Tonight, there's something more valuable that you possess than even what Naaman had. And you can exchange that just like this man did. And the rest of the story is just as awesome and gruesome for you as it is for him. Here was a man who had a good home in the best kind of association that could ever be. I mean, can you imagine going from being a servant to one of the great prophets of God? When the name Elisha comes up, he stands as one of the supreme Old Testament figures. For a life of an outcast? I mean, after all, the fellow who had leprosy in Israel was cast outside the camp. He was a fellow who lived his life as an outcast. He kind of begged for support from just whoever might give him something. And not only that, but if somebody like you that were whole even got too near to him, he had to warn you before you got up to where you might contaminate yourself and defile yourself to where you couldn't even do the things of God in service to God. And he had to put his hand over his mouth and cry out, unclean, unclean. You suppose this fellow really thought it was worth what he gained? Or do you suppose he got the worst part of the bargain? You know, this fellow had a long time to think about it, because it stayed with him until he died. How much worse will it be for those who make the worst exchange of all, their soul for things that are not the things of God, to dwell in the devil's hell throughout eternity, realizing too late that the exchange they've made was the worst one that they ever made in their life. I don't care what the devil offers or how much of it. If you lose your soul, Jesus says you've profited nothing. If tonight you realize the value of your soul, will you not be willing, if you've not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, to do that? To bow in humble submission to the Lord, to his will, to he who says, he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, he that believeth not shall be damned. If you're here as one that's done that, not lived like you should have, you think about what you're exchanging. It may be pleasureful now. It may be delightful now. You may appear or you may believe that you're getting by with it now. But if it costs you your soul, you're losing everything. You're losing the most precious possession you've got. Gehazi made a very sad exchange. But you make a worse one if you lose your soul. Aren't you here tonight willing to do what the Lord bids you to do? To make the exchange into the way of righteousness through the blood of Christ. That's what the Lord offers. That's what's extended now, while we stand and sing.